This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Today's episode of Gilmore Guys is brought to you by Blue Apron. Now, I'm doing the ad alone today because Demi unfortunately died and passed away because he tried to cook things using poisonous items around his apartment and died from them because he didn't know how to cook because he did not at the time have blueapron.com. But I do, and I live to tell you the tale. You need to know how to cook and not be dead. And cooking at home means eating healthier and saving money instead of ordering expensive takeout. But where do you start? Blue Apron has you covered. For less than $10 per meal, Blue Apron delivers all the fresh ingredients you need to create home-cooked meals. Just follow the easy step-by-step instructions. Each meal can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. No overwhelming trips to the grocery store. No sad dummy takeout. No matter your dietary preferences, Blue Apron makes it a breeze to discover and prepare dishes like Korean wings, chicken wings with rice cakes, or catfish piccata, maybe tandoori chicken with coconut basmati. I think I'm pronouncing those right. Or for you vegetarians out there, maybe a grilled cheese with brie and pear with arugula and Brussels sprout salad. Does that sound delightful and delicious yet, guys? Does it? It should. Recipes are between 500 to 700 calories per portion. Delicious and good for you. Right now, you can get your first two meals for free at blueapron.com/Gilmore Guys. That's blueapron.com/Gilmore Guys. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Today's episode of Gilmore Guys is brought to you by Tidal. Now, what is Tidal? You may have heard of it, but you're a little fuzzy on the details. Something about Jay-Z? Well, let me tell you, Tidal is a global entertainment platform built for fans directly from artists around the world. Tidal members enjoy exclusively curated content that directly connect artists with their fans. And as our fans know, it's all about the fans, baby. Tidal aims to provide members with the best content exclusively, whether it's a new track, album, music video, film, live stream, interactive experience, or video series. And they got a new video series starting this month in November. It's a stand-up comedy show hosted by DJ Sypha Sounds called No Small Talk, a blend of both comedy and music. Each episode is filmed at the Comedy Cellar in New York and includes three great comedians. You can catch amazing performers like Kareem Green, Omar Thompson, Lewis Katz, and more. This series is 5 episodes long, and new episodes are going to be released every Tuesday. The first episode is available for everyone on Tidal starting this month in November, and after that, the episodes are exclusive to Tidal subscribers. Go to Tidal.com to watch the premiere episode of No Small Talk. Just for our listeners, too, Tidal is giving away a 3-month free membership, so you can watch the entire series and stream other exclusive content, listen to your favorite tracks, watch upcoming live streams, and get early access to live shows. How cool, how fun. Sign up for a free 3-month trial at Tidal.com/NoSmallTalk. That is, once again, Tidal.com/NoSmallTalk. And download the Tidal app to check out Sypha's new show today. Tidal, catch the wave. Oh, that's not their catchphrase. I just assumed it was. Oh, they don't. It should be catch the wave, though, right? They should pay me for that. Okay, on with the show. Oh, yeah. Ba-ba, ba-ba, ease it in.
Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. Now we switch.
Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba, ba-ba-ba.
Kinda. Yeah, look, we sorta nailed it.
Yeah, it's like 90.
We hit part of the nail, but we didn't hit it right on the head. Right. Welcome to Gilmore Guys. I'm Kevin.
I'm Demi.
And we're the Gilmore Guys. And we have a very special Gilmore Gab episode today for you all. Thank you so much for joining us, everybody. All those out there in podcast land tuning in, which it's not really tuning in. You just download the episode and listen to it, right?
It's kind of like tuning in.
In a way, you're right. So, guys, we've talked to so many people on the show, so many people involved with the creation of it. We've talked to writers, we've talked to cast members, composers, but there's one person we haven't yet spoken to who is involved with the show. Who could that be? Well, if you're listening to this, you probably know because you saw it on the little podcast description.
Yeah.
But we're going to tell you anyway.
La, la,
la, la. special guest. Well, you may know him as Michelle Gerard on Gilmore Girls. Ladies and gentlemen, give it up for Yannick Truesdale.
Hello.
Hello. Oh, boy. Yannick, thank you so much for joining us.
You're pronouncing it right. So
Yannick.
Congrats.
Yes, thank you. I know. I was corrected earlier before the mic turned on. Well, because it is a weird thing. Like, sometimes we have, even in, like, the comedians we have on as guests and stuff, where there's interesting pronunciations, and so sometimes I forget before we start recording to ask them, like, okay, so it's pronounced like this. And then we get there, and we're like, pause real quick, so it's pronounced like this, and then we have to do the whole
thing
again.
There you go.
So, Yannick, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
My pleasure.
Now, we met briefly before in ATX at the festival on the red carpet, I believe, or I think we met in the green room like 10 minutes before or something like that.
I think we met on the red carpet.
Okay.
Yeah.
The trio, you, Liz, Jackson.
Right.
All that jazz. Red carpets are, because that's where we've met a lot of people from the show, like for the first time. There's some we knew before.
Right.
But red carpets are an interesting, like, exercise, right?
Correct.
Because especially in the ATX heat, what was it that day? Like 90?
It was insane.
Yeah, it was real bad.
Sweltering.
Yeah. You're from Canada.
I'm from Canada, but we don't have it that hot. Summers in Montreal are very humid.
Yeah.
I would say similar to New York. Maybe New York is a little more intense.
Sure.
But not that much. That day was just like fighting for your life.
And because we actually had the better end of the deal as press, because we were looking at you.
Right. You have the camera on your face.
You were looking at the sun.
Yeah. Yeah. True. That true.
Yeah.
But you know, being on camera, having your forehead dripping into your eyes and you're trying to look at people and try to see.
Yeah.
Was a little challenging.
It was. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's okay.
It's tough. And it's a cattle call, because then you answer the same question 7 times.
That's tough. And, yeah. I think that's the part for me that is the toughest, is to
find new ways to say the same thing.
Yeah, but at the same time, you just have one way. There's one way you have to say it about that specific question.
Right.
But there you're trying to reinvent the way you're answering when the other person didn't hear your answer. So you could actually just repeat the same thing over and over again.
Right.
But you feel like, oh, I should keep that fresh.
But then you feel like weirder, like, yeah, I should keep it fresh. So, like, what's the question you got every time that you answered over and over again?
I'm trying to remember. Why do you think the show remains popular?
Right, yeah.
Where do you think Michelle is today?
Yeah, which that's a toughie too. Because
that's a tough question.
That puts it on you to like create fan fiction in your head right now.
Yeah, and you're not the creator of the show. I've never written anything for Michelle. So it's just like, oh, well, so many things. It could be anything.
Right.
And he's always been an outsider. Someone from France. Living in that little village has always been strange to me.
Yeah.
I had to justify it for myself. Like, why is he there? And he's grumpy and miserable and he critiques everyone. So I was like, why doesn't he go back to France?
Yeah.
You know, all of that.
What keeps him there?
What keeps him there? But in the end, I think it's just cultural. French people, their way of connecting with others is to criticize and like analyze and be like this just
you've seen that
over and over again.
Yeah.
Like you can see two French people talking and you're like, oh, they're arguing, I'm wondering what's happening. No, they're just talking,
they're connecting.
Yeah. But like, no, I think this and this and that and that and that, and then the other person doesn't agree, and like that's why Paris for me is such a beautiful city, but I don't enjoy it much because the connection with the French is a lot about arguing and pushing and make like I'm not
abrasiveness.
Abrasiveness. Like New Yorkers, it's more like in a fun way. I don't perceive it the same way. French people, I just feel like, okay, give me a break.
Right.
You know, this should be easy.
Yeah.
I'm just like, you order at a restaurant in Paris, and if they don't agree with your drink, they'll say it. Oh, really? You're ordering a Coca-Cola with this?
Really?
Like, yeah, this is what I like.
There's a judgment.
There's a judgment about your order. I don't appreciate that part.
So, but it's a real picture of Michelle's character, too.
Yeah.
It's pretty much.
It's a love.
That's how he's connecting.
Yeah, that's how he's connecting. Yeah.
That's kind of a key to it. So what we try to do on this show in talking to the people who are involved in making it. Because I think for fans of the show, sometimes it's easy to get a myopic perspective like, okay, so this person, they did this show and that's what they're all about. Whereas in reality, Gilmore Girls represents a part of your life, right? Not your whole life. It's just a point in the story or whatever. So we're always interested in like who the people are that made the show. So for like you yourself, you come from Canada, right?
Right.
You were born in Canada.
Born and raised in Montreal.
Right on.
Right.
And were you interested in acting at a young age or?
Not really. No, I mean, I started at a young age. Mm-hmm. I went to acting school. I was 17. So
you started, but you were not interested.
No. No, I was not. I was in high school, and there was a girl in my class who asked me to be her scene partner because she wanted to be an actress and audition for the acting school.
Okay.
So I was like, oh, that's interesting. But I said, why are you asking me? I'm not an actor. I'm not sure I can do the job. And she said, no, you just have to read the lines. We'll find a scene and you just have to learn the lines and read the lines. I was like, maybe I should apply. Can I apply at the same time? She's like, yeah, I think you can.
Right.
So I just went with it. I don't really know why. I don't know. And then, of course, I got picked and she didn't.
Oh, dang.
life is weird, right? Yeah. She really, really wanted it.
Yeah.
I was like, let me try that. And then I got chosen and then I started going to school in the fall and then discovered that I had talent. I had no clue. No one ever told me, like, you should be an actor, you're so good, or this or that.
What were you interested in that wasn't acting when you were growing up?
I didn't know. I really did. First of all, 17 is very young.
Sure.
I thought I would be a good lawyer. I thought architecture was fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But I just didn't know exactly. I knew I needed validation somehow.
Mm-hmm.
which is pretty much a basic human need,
sure,
you
sure.
would say. So everyone needs validation. But I was craving it. Let's put it this way.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Sure.
So that's why I think her choice was appealing to me. It's like, oh, wow, acting. Like, oh, you're on stage. People look at you. Like, oh. And
it's a validation machine.
It's a validation machine. Yeah. And I think that was appealing to me. And I lucked out because I ended up having talent for it. Like, what I realize is that a lot of people want to be an actor, but they just don't have what it takes. And I just so happened that I had some talent. And,
sure.
And then I discovered that I loved it, which I didn't know.
Do you remember like a particular moment, like you were in a show or doing a play or performing in some way and you were like, you get off the stage and you're like, wow, the rush. Or was it there just was like a gradual
thing? It was a gradual thing, but I've always done well in acting school. Like the first year I was breezing, like all the feedback, like you kind of have to perform a little show or a scene every two or three months, I forgot what it was. And then you get critiques and reviewed by the teachers. And every time it was extremely positive when other people in my class were like struggling because they let go of people over the first year and second year. And in the third year, you'll graduate.
That's kind of the crazy thing about a lot of acting schools is it's set up like a reality show elimination thing.
Yeah, you get eliminated.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of stress and competition that comes with it. But because my first year was so good and the feedback was always good that I didn't have that stress of like, oh my God, I'm not going to make it to the second year. But you know, we started 20 something and we finished like 9. You know, we started 22 or 24. So anyway, but I think it was the end of my first year, I did a Molière, and it was all the teachers are people in the industry that, you know, most of the time you admire and you're like, oh my God, I can't believe this is my teacher. And you really look up to them.
And what was this school again?
National Theatre School of Canada.
National Theatre.
Yeah. Canada. So, and then I did a Molière, but Guy Nadon was my teacher. And something happened in that scene. I was playing Tartuffe, and I was just for the first time very much in the moment and forgot that I was who I was, but I've become the character and very involved in the pursuit and the objective that this character wanted. And the scene ended, and I was like, oh, wow, I've never experienced it that way. That must be – and I got, you know, phenomenal – feedback on that one, and something clicked there. I was like, wow, this I touched something deeper and more authentic in what I was doing.
It felt transcendent in a way.
A little bit, yeah.
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 And it stopped being a craft as much as it did, like an experience.
Right. That was magical. There's something
powerful.
Magical in that moment. Yeah.
Cool. So, okay, so everything's going well, acting school, acting academy.
Yeah.
And then from there, making the jump from that world to the professional world and actually working.
Yeah, I lucked out. You have to go back. I'm old. When I came out of...
36.
Right.
Yes.
Yes, that'd be lovely. When I came out of acting school in Quebec and in Montreal and all that, there was one other black actor.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very easily identified. Mm. I did a show. There was a famous director who put together a show for the national celebration that summer. I graduated in May, and the show was June 24th. And he picked three actors from each school. So there's four school acting schools, and he put the show together. So to be picked to be on that show was a big thing because everyone wanted to be on that show. It was like a professional show with this famous director, and I got picked. And then I did that show. And then after that show, I forgot what happened, but someone gave my name to host the National Celebration of Quebec, which is like, you know, the 4th of July here, TV,
Ooh.
Live. But I've never hosted anything. I've never done television. I just came out of acting school. And so me and another actress who had just graduated, it was supposed to be this famous actors couple that were supposed to host it. I'm not sure what happened, but they ended up...
Donnie and Marie Osmond.
Yes, exactly. They ended up hiring new actors.
Sure.
And that was the concept, I think. And then I was on television hosting in front of 10,000 people live, a live show with the most famous singers and all that. It was a big 2-hour show on television. And that was my first TV experience.
Oh, wow.
And then I had done the play that, you know, that summer at the same time. And then I ended up doing a sitcom. I was recurring on a sitcom. And at the time, the writer of that sitcom was the biggest thing on television.
A Canadian sitcom?
A Canadian sitcom.
Well, do you remember the show?
I remember the show. It was called D'Amour et d'Amitié. It was in French. And it was about a family. And I was friends with one of the kids on that family. And that writer, who was a big deal at the time, he no longer writes. I'm not sure what happened. Was writing a sequel of a very famous show he had done years before, and he wrote me in that new show.
Okay.
Yeah. So then I started doing television very quickly. And so I went and did that show, and at the same time, I had auditioned to play. a hockey player when I had never played hockey and I didn't know how to skate.
Great.
I lied at my audition, and I got the job. And I went to the first rehearsal on ice, and I was like, fuck, how am I going to do this? And I went to talk to the director, and he was very busy, and I said, Richard, can I just talk to you for a few minutes? He said, not now, after the rehearsal. I said, but I would need to talk to you now before. He's like, Yannick, I'll talk to you after. I don't have time right now. I said, Richard, I don't know how to skate. And he turned around and he's like, okay, well, do what you can. And so I went. At first of all, I didn't even know how to put the equipment on. So I was looking at people how they And then I walked. I was kind of walking on the ice. It was really bad. I was humiliated. But in the end, none of the actors that were hired were good enough to pull off. He Shoots His Scores was a very famous series about hockey and hockey players. And none of the actors were good enough to play professional hockey players on the ice. So we ended up all being dubbed. Like, we all had people dubbing all of the game stuff on the ice. So I kept the job. They didn't fire me.
Oh, so it was like different actors skating.
Different actors
and then
skating.
The voice.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, cut to ESPN game or something.
Yeah, exactly. So... I'm not sure I would do that again, lying like that at an audition.
Right. That seems to be a common theme. We had Rose Abdu on the show who plays Gypsy.
Yeah.
And she lied about being able to drive for a job that she had to
do. She didn't know how to drive.
She didn't know how to drive because she's from Chicago and she wasn't driving. So she got a job and she had to learn in like 3 days or something.
Oh,
I think
my
it was.
God.
So that seems like a common, that's a good nugget to take away.
Yeah, driving, I would think, I don't know. You can kind of pull it off. Skating, it's not an easy thing to do if you've never
skating's
done
a toughie,
it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a tough one.
And I have friends who, like, they've tried so hard, it's just something they can't learn. So for some people, it's just, it's an unlearnable skill.
I didn't have it.
Can you skate now?
No.
Have you tried?
Well, I haven't tried.
You
well,
should try.
We'll go to the ice rink
we're
after
going,
this.
We're going to the ice rink after the podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
That'd be so fun. Demi played hockey for how many
Four
years? 4 years.
Oh, no. You did?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
I was one of the people that got dubbed in.
No. Yo. Oh, yeah. You were on that show.
No.
Oh, man. Oh. So you're doing Canadian TV.
Yeah. So I'm doing Canadian television. And then that's like the first year that I came out. And then I was at a party. And a famous director was there. And he said, oh, you know, you're so funny. You should do like Hazard Fall, the Birdcage.
Mm-hmm.
There's, you know, the part of the maid is a funny part and it's staged and all that. And I was like, oh, you know, the idea kind of grew on me. And I ended up negotiating the right for the play and then trying to pitch the play and get the play produced. But I was, you know, 19 years old, 20, I'd never negotiated the right. So anyway, and it was a very famous agent in Paris who was right. representing this famous writer. So by the end, he wouldn't even pick up my calls, the agent. So I have an impression of a French woman's voice that I do on the phone. I've been doing it for 20 years.
Okay.
And she closed the deal. I made her call.
You pretended to be a French woman.
Exactly.
What does she sound like?
That, well, I would have to do it in French. I don't know how to do it in English.
Oh, that's fine.
Go for it.
I haven't done it in like a year, so hold on 1 second. Bonsoir, Monsieur Poiret. Bernadette Lacange à l'appareil. Vous allez bien? Je vous appelle de la part de Monsieur Trousdal à Montréal. Voilà.
Perfect.
That is
flawless.
Fantastic.
See, it's a validation machine.
Yeah, it's a validation. But yeah, Bernadette is a running gag between me and my friends, and she's been my assistant, quote unquote, for years, and would call for me. And
we
and
had to talk to Bernadette for months before having you on our show. It was a long negotiation.
Yeah, she's
process.
A tough cookie.
Yeah, what yeah, people don't know.
Yeah, yeah,
man,
yeah.
Her emails are short.
So anyway, Bernadette. negotiated the rights. I got the rights of the play and pitched it to this very famous director, and we ended up doing it. It was a huge success. So coincidentally, He Shoots His Scores was airing on the air.
Mm-hmm.
Was playing a hockey player. It was a drama. It was television. And I was playing Jacob, the maid, the biggest queen part on stage. It was comedy.
Right.
So within 6 months.
What a contrast.
Right.
Yeah.
People saw me doing television, drama, comedy on stage. I got rave reviews for the play. And it just kind of opened up the market for me and the world. So it from that point, I mean, I'm not one that has always worked constantly.
Mm-hmm.
Like I've always worked, but I work. I have a big hit. No one thinks of me for like 6 months. Then something else happened. Like I've always been so jealous and envious of actors that land a big thing and then they work for 30 years, right. It seems.
Yeah,
I don't have that yeah. path. Yeah. I've never had that path.
So what was the next thing after The Birdcage? And in that time doing He Shoots, He Scores.
Yeah. Well, then I ended up kind of doing a play a year. That ended up being that for a long time, until I moved here, actually,
mm-hmm.
for like 10 years.
Which was when? When did you move out to L.A.?
I moved to L.A. the year before Gilmore Girls. So Gilmore Girls was in 2000.
So it was like 99. Okay.
I moved in 99. Yeah.
Do you remember the first audition for the show?
Gilmore?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Of course. Yeah, it was but first of all, my first audition for Gilmore
mm-hmm.
was my first audition in L.A.
What?
Oh, wow.
So I cannot not remember that.
Wow.
Yeah.
First audition. Come on.
Yeah, yeah.
Get
yeah.
out of town.
Well, I didn't have I didn't have an agent. I didn't have anyone.
Wow.
No one would take me. It was crazy. It was very brutal for me to move here a little bit in my bubble. I mean,
sure.
I'm in Canada. I'm doing television. People know me and all that stuff. So I came here. My father was American from New York, so I grew up speaking French with my mom.
Your mom was French?
My mom is French.
Okay.
So I was just like, oh, and I was raised by my mom and half by my grandmother, who was Francophone, but for some reason would only watch American television.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't speak English, but I would watch it with her, and it was our moment together, and she would translate like, "Oh, she just said that," and I was like, "Oh my god!" So that would be our. So for me, when I graduated from acting school, in my mind, I would always come to the U.S. because I've watched American television all of my childhood. So I didn't watch much of French television or Canadian television. So it was just like a natural. My dad was from the U.S. It just felt like, oh, this is where I'm going to end up working. Totally. But then I got trapped in like working and I was enjoying myself and having success and validation, which I wanted to have.
Sure.
So I was like, oh, okay, well, I'm going to stay here. And then something happened in 97. I was doing a sitcom for a big network. And it was very much like Friends, a group of young kids living together. And I was the spoiled kid in the group. And it was a breakout character for me.
Not like Friends if there's a non-white character in it.
Yeah, true. I was the only black character right. in it. But my brother was Chinese. I was adopted.
So okay.
My brother was Chinese and my sister was, I forgot what she was. I think they were both Asian and I was black. And the first episode, my parent kicked me out because I'm a spoiled kid and they can't deal with me anymore. and basically, anyway, it was a huge hit. But because the television in Canada is all financed by the government, after the first season...
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Wow.
After the first season, I got nominated for a Gemini. The show got nominated for a Gemini. The writing... I mean, we got like 12 nominations. It was a huge, huge, huge hit. Just keep that in mind. And the network didn't pick up the show for a second season because the same producers had another show that was the biggest show on television, and they screwed the network over, I think, over negotiation, and they had all the power. So the network, to kind of get back at them, they were like, oh, all right, fine. That new show that you have that is a hit is not coming back.
Oh, man. Dang.
Bye-bye.
Wow. Botched negotiations.
Yeah.
It's a theme.
And it just made me realize the nature of the business in Canada. It doesn't matter if it's a hit, not a hit, the money will still come in. It's financed by the government.
Wow. Yeah.
So it's kind of crazy. And I was.
So what ends up succeeding in Canada if that's the case?
Well, I mean, that's an example of something that can happen.
Sure.
If it's a hit, most likely it will remain there
right.
for a while. But what I'm saying, the stakes are not the same because it won't change anything in their budget. They will.
Yeah.
The network will have their budget the following year the same.
It'll be the same losses or profits.
Yeah. It doesn't change anything. Okay. So if you have a nice lunch with someone and you're like, they have a new show and you're like, oh, yeah, you know, let's do that show next year. And then you find a spot and you cancel someone and, you know. So I just couldn't deal with it. I just thought it was so unfair. We had really created something special. Loved the writing. I loved the show. And I just... was fed up with it. So I took a year off and I went to study at Lee Strasberg in New York. And I didn't work for a year. And I just went back to the craft. And I loved it so much. And also I had, it made me real. I, by the way, barely spoke English back then.
But, well, because you were learning from TV shows.
I was learning from TV shows, but my English was very broken, very limited vocabulary. But I just went anyway because I didn't care and I just wanted to have a year off in New York and study the method and all of that. I was very curious about it. And even though I had really basic English, obviously I could learn my scenes that I was working on.
Mm-hmm.
But I could I made me realize that I could make people laugh even in another language because comedy has always been my thing. And then to be in a class where no one – because after doing television for 10 years and you're kind of famous and all of that – whatever you do, people are like, oh, he's so great. People laugh at anything.
Right.
You're in that position. You've proved yourself. You've got great reviews. So people just expect. And you kind of like roll in that zone where you don't have as much feedback on your work as you did when you first started.
Yeah, it's hard. It's almost like when bigger comedians go up. Now,
probably,
like people who are like super well known, like a Louis C.K. or an Aziz or something.
Right.
And there's a moment where, like, I've seen it happen where, like, the first 10 minutes, everyone's laughing at everything.
Right.
Because there's such this goodwill generated, like, it's the guy from TV.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But then what I found too is that goes away sometimes.
Right.
You know, like, the first 10 minutes, and it's like just a guy on stage.
Right. Then what is he saying?
Right.
That's when it turns into stories.
Right.
Where the big laugh is just the idea that, like, this is still happening. Yeah.
Right. So, so for me to be in New York speaking English in a class with people that had no clue who I was or anything, and getting a class, an entire class laugh at my choices and stuff, it made me realize, like, okay, maybe, just maybe I'm good enough to do this outside of Canada. Maybe I should come here. And I decided to stay in New York. And it's like, I found an apartment, which is crazy hard to find an apartment in New York. And I was just going to go and pack my things in Montreal and move to New York and do theater. I'm a theater lover. Theater is my home.
Sure.
And I had a conversation. I called a friend in LA, my only friend that I knew in LA, and told her that I had found an apartment. I was all excited that I was moving to New York. And we had a two-hour conversation on the phone where she said, I think you're doing a mistake. I think if you're moving here, now if you want to be on Broadway, people have to know you. You should come to LA. Everything is in LA. You should do television and people will know you and it'll be easier to be on Broadway. And I really, really didn't want to hear that. I didn't like LA. I had been in LA once. It didn't feel like a city to me.
It was a negative experience.
It was a negative experience. I didn't feel any connection with the city at the time. But I slept on it, and even though I didn't want her to be right, I felt that she was right, and I canceled the apartment.
Oh, dang.
Canceled the apartment, and I moved to LA. It was a big thing, but I just felt like that's what needed to happen, and so that's what I did. And I arrived, and I thought, like, okay, well, I need to get an agent, I need to get a manager. Let's find a place. Like, I had my list, but didn't think that anything would get in the way of my list.
Mm-hmm.
You know, been on television, and I was not getting the answer, response.
Right.
No one would hire me. No one would take me on board in their agency, a big press kit. No one was interested. So it's very, very soul-crushing 10 months where I got very depressed, would call home, speak to my mom, cry, and she'd be like, you don't have to do this. If you come back here, you'll work.
Were your parents always pretty supportive of this?
I mean, I have a mom. I never had a dad. Don't know my dad. He passed away anyway. So my mom, yes. My mom, I grew up with a hippie mom. She's a yoga teacher. She's been a yoga teacher for 35 years. She's an artist. She was a photographer. She's a painter. She's very artistic, very free-spirited. So anything I would do, she would support as long as I'm happy. Right. And I was not happy. I was crying all the time. So it's like, okay, well, why are you staying there? You don't have to stay there.
Right.
And I was doing The Artist's Way. I don't know if any of you know that book.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, it's a great book. And what's his name? Coppola's wife, former, anyway, I can't remember. I can't think of her name right now. Anyway, famous book, very creative book. Anyone that is an artist, I'd say they should do that book. And you do all kinds of exercises, morning pages. I don't know if you've ever heard about that exercise, morning pages that a lot of actors and writers do.
Yeah. It's like you have to write a certain amount of pages.
Yeah, three in the morning without thinking or whenever. And so I was doing the book. And in the book, she said, be very specific about what represents success, what this and that or whatever. And then I had picked a date for the universe, the city to show me some love and that I should stay here. The date was my birthday, which is March 17th. I was like, and I was very clear with that choice. If by my birthday, I don't have a clear sign that I should stay here, I'm going back home. That's it. And Gilmore Girls deal came 10 days before my birthday.
Woo!
How did that deal come about without an agent?
Without an agent. So that friend that made me move here, Sabine Carsanti, who's an actress at the time, she's no longer, but she had done a movie with John Travolta, one of the worst movies ever made, called Battlefield Earth.
I was going to say.
What?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, my God.
She's the female lead in that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Very pretty, great, very smart girl. And she had a meeting, lunch with an agent who was kind of flirtatious with her, and she didn't want to go to the lunch by herself, so she said, why don't you come along with me?
Hey, kind of like how you got into the whole acting thing.
Yeah, true. I didn't think about that. And then I showed up. I'm not sure he was thrilled to see me there. But I was there at the lunch. And, you know, I was trying to compensate for me being there. So I was extremely charming and funny and trying to make it light and fun for him.
And at this point, your English was good.
Not good, but better.
Better.
I was working on it. I was working on it. Taking lessons and working on the accent, and I worked with the best dialect coach that this country has, I think, had. He passed away, Sam Schwa, who coached Pacino and everyone, like pretty much everyone in the industry. Wow. So I've worked with him on the accent thing. So I was working towards improving everything. And where am I going with this, Sabine?
The Gilmore Girls deal.
And how yes. And then so I went to this lunch and I never thought about it ever again. He was an assistant at CAA at the time, mm-hmm. Michael. Then it became an agent I didn't know. And I get a call one day and he's like, hey, dude, it's Michael Goldberg. Remember? And I was like, oh, Michael, yeah. He's like, I just became an agent and I saw this breakdown. And I thought you'd be right for it. Do you want to go? And I was like, yeah, I haven't auditioned here yet. He's like, oh, cool. So I went and it was Gilmore. And the first audition went very well. When I read this, I was like, okay, if I don't get this or if I don't get very close to get this, this is not the place for me. Because it really felt like I could bring something very specific and my strength as an actor were in that part. And then I auditioned and then I didn't hear anything for like 2-3 weeks. And I was like, can you call back? It's kind of weird, like, that I didn't even get, like, a call back on this. And then he called back, and they said, oh, actually, we were going to call back. Yes, he has a call back. Mm-hmm. And then the call back, I think, was with Amy.
Mm. And that was your first time meeting her?
That was my first time meeting her.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And then I had another call back with Amy and Gavin and the casting director again. And then I went to network. And then I went to studio.
Was the audition, because you had done so much TV in Canada,
yeah.
Was it similar or very dissimilar in America in terms of having to do, like, you get the call back and then you do it with the
You don't have
producer.
Five auditions in Canada.
Okay.
No. If anything, you get one call back and that's it.
Okay.
But because I had been on TV for so long, I didn't have any of that stuff anymore.
Gotcha.
You know, I sometimes perhaps would audition, but often not. Mm-hmm. So it's just going back to the roots of you know, doing it and auditioning. I'm not too bad at it. So it's good. Like, I'm not someone who panics or become extremely – if I have the material long enough, like a couple of days here, what I hate, it's like at 5 o'clock, you get an audition, it's the next morning at 10.
There's no respect
for the actor's process. And I'm from the theater where you have so much time to sit on it and really have time to dig into it as opposed to just – give your first impression, which is more like a sketch of mm-hmm. what this part could be, because you don't have time. So most of the time here, you're just sketching. Okay, this is what I could do.
Right. Maybe, yeah.
But it's not the best performance.
Yeah.
And with Gilmore particularly, where pages come in so late, was that very stressful for you to get, like...
I mean, rarely, a couple of times I've been in a situation where you get the pages the morning or like... a couple, but rarely. I've always gotten the script long enough in advance that, and it's also different when you're on a show, you know your character, you know the rhythm of the character, you know the voice, you know, so that you don't have to search for any of that stuff. Right. Auditioning, you're searching for everything.
Right.
You don't know that guy. You have to create that guy. When you know
you
the guy,
met him. Yeah.
When you know the guy and you know the character you're playing, it's much easier to have lines last minute. Right. So, yeah. But that didn't happen that much for me on Gilmore.
Do you remember the moment that you found out that you would be this character?
Oh, my God, yes.
And you would be the series
regular? I was in Santa Monica Boulevard going to the gym, or I just came out of Starbucks, and I got the call.
Those are two different things.
Yeah.
Very different things.
Yeah. I forgot. But anyway, I know exactly which corner I was. I was going to my car, and I got the call, and I was just crying. Mm-hmm. Crying from all the stress of being here and having been so difficult. I mean, in retrospect, 10 months is not a long time to land a dream job.
Sure.
But you don't know that.
Right.
You know.
So people go years here without doing that.
Years, but... yeah. But and a lifetime without landing a job mm-hmm. like that. So very fortunate. Now I can see. But when I was in the midst of it, it felt very long.
And who called you to tell you that?
The agent.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, the thing that I didn't talk about, so by the time Michael called me for the meeting, mm-hmm. I had signed with a tiny agent in the valley.
Mm-hmm.
But he still...
The agency was tiny. The man was normal size.
Right, right. Yeah. That's right. And then so, even though it's Michael who booked me that appointment on Gilmore Girls, I was with another agent.
Oh.
Yeah. So I left her after a year and I went with Michael. Yeah.
So you get the call, you're doing Gilmore, and then at this point, you go to shoot the pilot.
In Toronto.
Back in Toronto.
Yeah, back home.
Go back in the homeland. Yeah. That must have felt comfortable, though, in a weird way, because you're like, all right. You know.
Yeah, but it was my first time shooting in English.
Oh, wow.
That's true.
Yeah.
I'd never thought about that.
I'd never done anything
in
English.
Had you done stage work in English at this point?
No.
Wow.
No, never.
So let's talk about that then, and then in terms of like, the accent of the character Michelle.
Right.
Because your natural accent that you have as someone for whom French is your first language is not as exaggerated as it is for Michelle.
No.
So what was the direction there? Like, what were the conversations from the beginning? Was that a choice you made in the audition? They're like, okay, great, keep doing that.
It was written with an accent.
Right.
So, it was said in the script that he had an accent, so I just naturally did a French accent. Mm-hmm. But it was tricky, the first half of the year,
mm-hmm.
because Amy was very specific about what she wanted, but she didn't want the accent to be too thick so that people could understand. But at the same time, if you want to be truthful and authentic, you have to kind of do it a certain way. So I was kind of Mickey Mousing a French accent and then compromising with Amy's desire to make sure that people understand what I'm saying, which is a legitimate question, a legitimate thing to
so
want.
So you split the difference.
A little bit. Yeah. A little bit. Because there's a lot of many different ways you can go with a French accent. Right. It can be very, very, French people, they can talk like everything is z.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can remove just the z and make the th better so that when they talk, they can talk with a French accent, but they can still do some ths a little bit,
Okay, so that's what...
So that I kind of dimmed down and...
Right.
Like, so it was a year of like,
Adjusting the levels.
The level. A little more of that, a little less of that, this and that. And then I think we kind of found it, and that was that.
Right.
And we didn't touch that.
Because the character was written to be a French person.
Yes. Much older.
Really?
Yes, much
older. Oh, he was supposed to be older.
Oh, yeah, like in his 50s, I think, at first.
That's funny. Yeah. That's something that we did not know about.
Yeah.
That would give way to his grumpiness.
The breakdown.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, Michelle is a very young man.
Yeah.
and it's like, why is he so world? But I mean, I guess it makes sense because he's French. But
yeah.
Him being like a 60-year-old grump makes total sense.
It was 50. I think originally they were looking for someone in their 50s.
Wow.
Because that stature, that there's something that comes with age with that's, what's the word in English? When someone is hautain, but I don't know I actually don't know the word in English. But there's something...
World weariness or...
No. Like there's a presence that you get when you get older, mm-hmm. that it's hard to get when you're like 28, 29.
Okay. Like a perspective.
Something more in the energy of a character. But I've always kind of had that even when I was young. So I think when they saw me, they were like, oh, this could work because he's bringing some maturity that someone would have at an older age, but he's younger.
Right. So in the first year, kind of adjusting the levels.
Right.
How much accent versus... So it was written to be a French person. Was it written to be a person of color as well? Or was that part of the breakdown? Or was it just like all ethnicities apply?
I am not sure.
Because you...
I want to say black. Yeah, I want to say it's an African American. I want to say.
Interesting.
I may be wrong, but I want to say... Because I think that was one of the reasons why I felt like, okay... African-American, French accent, condescending, dry, patronizing, all of the things that I can do in my sleep. That's why I was like, okay.
You can be African-American in your sleep.
Yeah, I can be African-American in my sleep, yes. So I think that's why it really felt like, okay, I need to get this type of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay, so and when did it start feeling comfortable doing the show? When did it feel like, if you can remember, like, a moment or an episode or just like a general time where it's like, I know who Michelle is. We figured out the accent stuff. We've toned it to the place we want it to be. Because some people we've talked to, like Liza, said she didn't feel comfortable on the show until like season 4 in
what?
Doing
Why?
It.
Why?
Well, she never knew, like, she always thought each year was going to be her last year.
But I think I felt like that too.
Really?
Yeah. But I think that's like a natural.
That's just like an actor's tendency.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You always think like, oh, they don't need me. They're going to fire me. Oh, this storyline's not going to happen. I mean, it was called the Gilmore. Any show that you're doing that is called like Gilmore Girls. I'm not a girl. I'm not a Gilmore. So the show can exist without you.
Right.
You know?
Is the thought.
Yeah,
but is there
the thought.
A point where you ever, that doubt went away and you were just like, oh, I'm here until it's done?
No, never. Oh my God. Wow. No, it's not my personality. No.
Wow.
No,
so
no.
Throughout the run of the show, it's just
maybe
this is it. Maybe this is it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
very much so.
Do you remember how you felt or where you were when you got the news that the show itself was done?
Oh, that it was canceled.
Yes.
That it was canceled. Yeah. I must have been in Canada because I was always in Canada. During the show, I was always in Canada. I would film, go home.
Really?
Really? Oh, so you kind of
did not like LA that
much. I did not like LA at that time.
That's kind of the Kelly Bishop, Ed Herman model, too.
Yeah.
They would fly from
the
East Coast. Yeah.
Same. I mean, I had a house here. I was here more than they were.
Yeah.
But as soon as, like, let's say they were trying, we get to a point where I was asking them to put me either earlier in the shooting schedule or at the end. And then the following episode, if I was in it, to put me, let's say if I worked later in the schedule, then to work earlier in the following right. schedule so that all my days would be together and then right. I'd be home for a while.
Because that would be kind of messed up. And I'm sure that happened where it's like you're in this episode and then 2 episodes later you're in this episode and then you're just flying back and forth.
Yeah, there was a lot of flying back and forth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But overall, okay, so you were in Canada when you probably got the news that it was canceled.
Yes, for sure.
Was the feeling during that 7th season... Well, let's just talk about that for a second.
Yeah.
Amy and Dan leave after season 6.
That's weird. By the way, I don't even think that could happen in Canada. I've never seen that. That the creator is no longer part. If the creator would leave in Canada, the show would end.
Right.
That's such a bizarre thing to me that the voice is no longer there and let's imitate the voice.
Which is wild because it happens a lot in American television.
Yeah, it happens a lot here.
It's happened with Community, with The West Wing, with Gilmore Girls, with plenty of shows.
I mean, because they have a success on their hands and they're like, okay, let's try to make this work. But has it been successful on other shows?
I can't think of a situation where everyone was like, it still is great.
Not creatively. Yeah. I think what West Wing did, it just kind of leveled out after that. But I think it continued to go down. But no, I don't think there's an example of like they replaced the voice and it was awesome.
Right.
Like, because that must have felt, was that hard to take when you got the news of that, when you knew that Amy and Dan were leaving?
Well, I was very surprised that that could happen. And I found out that they weren't coming in Paris. I just remembered. I was sitting at a restaurant by myself in Paris during the summer, and Amy and Dan walk in front of me.
Whoa.
What?
I'm like, and you know when you have a moment, you're at the end of the world, and I see that and I'm like, a double take, but I'm thinking, okay, it's not them. It can't be them. Sure. How would they be here at the same time as me on the same street, the same corner? And it was them. And I was like screaming. There was, oh my God, this is crazy. This is crazy. Yeah. And then Amy said, so I said, I'll see you. I think we were in like June, end of June. And I said, I'll see you like in 3 weeks. And she's like, oh no. Oh, you haven't heard. I'm like, no, what? She's like, I'm not coming back. We're not coming back.
Oh, wow.
I was like, You're not coming? Are we done? Is the show done? She's like, no, the show's not done. We're not coming. So I found out that way.
That's wild.
Yeah. I was in Paris. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. So that was bizarre. But then I was like, okay, well, it's Hollywood. Maybe that's how it works. I don't know. So I came back and not knowing if the show was going to work as well. Maybe it could. Like, I didn't know. But it was a little strange. A little strange. Something was missing.
Yeah. Where did you feel the most as an actor? Like what did you feel the most change either with the character of Michelle or just in general,
environment? In general, I think the environment was nice, but it was more like the writing. It's really, I mean, she's very specific. She has a very specific voice. It's a tough voice to copy.
Yeah.
And even though the writers knew the show very well and knew the characters very well, you're still trying to be someone else. And that's a tough mandate. That's, yeah, I don't know.
It almost seems better in that sort of situation to just try to do something entirely different, because it almost seems like a fool's errand. Like, what ended up happening on West Wing was they kind of just made it a different show. Like, they're on the campaign trail, and it's not at all familiar with, like, there's some of the older characters, but a lot of new characters, and they make it a different thing. But on Gilmore, you really couldn't do that.
No.
And so for you, well, let's talk about the reunion, like, and just the general feeling of ATX and everything that happened.
It's surreal a little bit for me.
Because that was probably your first time seeing all of them together, and...
Yeah, I see some of them, but yeah, first time seeing all them together. But mainly what was surreal to me is how intense that weekend was, and how intense that event was, and how intense the fans are still, like, so involved. Like, I see them on the street, you know, I travel the world, like, I was in Europe this summer, I'm always in Europe during the summer, and everywhere I go, people know the show and love the show and get excited. But, like, in a more casual way, like, they're excited and they want a picture, but that's that. But to have put, like, you know, I don't know, 5,000 fans or I don't know how many, it just made that whole weekend so intense, and it felt like we were doing the show all over again, like, because we got that reaction when the show came, like, the first year and second year or third year. It was very, very intense on the streets. And
really?
Yeah, for me,
so
anyway.
So you felt that, wow.
Oh, a lot. Yeah, I don't know if it's because I'm black and then people just, I was the only black person on the show, so very easily identified. I don't know. But anywhere anywhere I went, like, you know, in New York at night on a bike, and people would see the back of my head and scream, Michelle! Yeah. And, like, how did they see me? I'm on a bike flying, like, you know.
Sure. It's a distinct look. Sure.
Yeah, I don't know, I guess. I don't know. But, yeah, so I hadn't felt that enthusiasm in a long time. So that was strange to connect with that.
It was funny too, just like, speaking of what you were saying, the level of intensity, people like Jackson getting, you know, mobbed in the lobby of the hotel.
Yeah,
room.
We couldn't go out.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
Yeah,
we couldn't go out of the room.
Yeah, because you would get like five requests for pictures just going to the bar or something.
Oh,
you know?
But I didn't even deal with the lobby. But Liza and I, we tried to go for a sandwich and we had to turn around and come back. It was too much.
Wow.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's
funny. Yeah. It was. That's why I'm saying it was a little surreal. It felt like, okay, who are those people?
Very concentrated.
Yeah.
Predominantly. Yeah. In your experience, how many male fans have come up to you?
A lot.
From the show?
No, a lot.
More than you would think.
More than you would think.
Yeah. Because that's what we found, too, even in doing our live shows and stuff, is, like, there seems to be a good amount of the perception is, like, it's mostly a female audience, and that's true, but there's a lot more men,
but for
obviously.
Some reason, but for some reason, when it's a guy, they always say, like, I know I'm not supposed to watch, but, and, like, they feel like they have to justify.
Yeah,
I'm like, no, you don't have to justify.
Yeah.
No.
Like what you like without guilt
or
shame.
Yeah, exactly.
Start a podcast about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, man. And then the event itself was cool, but I just felt like because there were so many people on stage, it was hard to give everyone their
due.
True.
True.
You know, and being more of a photo op. But
yeah.
But it was really great to see that and emotional. And then now with the revival news of Netflix and whatnot.
Right.
Picking it up for 4 episodes.
I mean, but that's a rumor more than a news.
Well, what's your perspective on now? You haven't really talked to anyone.
No. I mean, no. Like, I've talked to some, and they're like, did you get a call? No, I didn't get a call. Like, so I don't know what's happening. I don't really know if perhaps there's some truth to it, but I'm in no position to confirm or deny. Like, I have no clue.
Right. Because no one's signed on yet, I guess, is the thing.
No. Well, not that I know of.
Right.
I think I wouldn't know.
It seems so strange that we keep getting more news about here's how it's going to go down, and they still haven't been like, well, it seems like to write this show, they would need to know who is involved.
To know who's in,
So
all the particulars.
I don't think it's so much a rumor as it is just news that got out way too early.
That's what
it feels like to me, is because, like, and what we've heard is, like, it was supposed to come out in a different way because, like, no one signed yet. Like, Graham said, can't confirm or deny on Twitter. You know, everyone's being real cagey about it.
Right.
So it's tough. But the thought of being able, you know, regardless of the rumor.
Yeah.
Like the thought of being able to end the show the way Amy wants it to.
Yeah.
That's exciting, right?
That would be awesome. I mean, it was, I think for most of us, frustrating. We left season 7 for a hiatus without thinking that we weren't coming back,
right.
Really. We didn't have a wrap party.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't. So just that part.
You didn't have a wrap party at all?
No, not at all.
That's weird. Well,
no.
Because cause I feel like you would have one just for the season anyway.
No, I think we always have like a little get-together drink stuff, which we always have. So we had that. But what I mean is it wasn't a wrap party like, oh, the series is done.
Right.
Goodbye. It was great working with you. We didn't have a moment to say goodbye to those people we've worked with for 7 seasons. So that part is really sucky because there was people that were important in my life for 7 years. And to not have been able to say, that was awesome, and I'm really happy that we did that together, and a hug and all of that, to a proper goodbye, just to the crew. That alone was never given to us. So that part is, to me, really...
Did you end up getting pretty friendly with the crew?
Yeah, of course. Hey, listen, you wake up
after 5
a.m.
Years,
7 years, you wake up at 5, you all like... You share a lot. It was a tough show. We shot... many, many, many hours. I mean, I was not Lauren or Alexis, but it was, you know, I remember a day we shot 23 hours and I worked and then they said, go home. And then I called and I said, and they had been working for like 17 hours. And she said, well, we'll call you if we get to that scene. Then I got a call at 2 a.m. and she said, can you come in? It's like, what? You guys are still shooting? It's just brutal. Like I walked on stage and people were like, there were zombies.
Yeah.
Like, so you become tight.
It's almost like wartime.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, it was.
I mean, it's making a TV show.
Yeah,
but still, it's making a TV show. It feels like you're in the trenches together.
Yeah.
Just as expensive as war.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you get close to people and it becomes your second family. Yeah.
Do you feel like ATX gave you a good sense of closure that kind of lacked from the way the show ended? Or did you still feel like... Because I guess most of the crew wasn't at ATX.
No, there were no crew members. Yeah. No, I got no closure from ATX. What I got from ATX is how it reconnected me to the success of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Like in a big way. I was like, oh, wow. Just reminded me how popular this show is and how people are involved still. And also what was fascinating to me is to see a room filled with 20-year-olds.
Yeah, because younger fans.
Yeah, younger. Well, fans that the same age as they were when we did the show.
Same age as the show.
As the show, yeah. But so, which is clearly a whole new generation that have discovered it. And that's fascinating to me. Then it means like, oh, wow. Okay, so it keeps growing.
The cycle of it.
The cycle of it. And that's fascinating to me. I'd never been in a show like that. This is the first time I'm in a show that... Oh, I see a new generation of it's that right. Part is really
fascinating. Because probably a majority of TV shows have their moment, they have their time in the sun, and then they kind of fade away
Something new comes up, and then people talk about that new show.
Yeah,
yeah.
For the character of Michelle, you talked about how you had to justify why he would stay in the small town.
Yeah.
What other sort of like, as an actor, when you come to a character like that, what kind of backstory do you give him? A backstory? Do you say like, well, I think Michelle had this kind of childhood and he grew up wanting to do this to make all those choices make sense as you're playing him? Like, what is that process like?
I don't really have to go back to the childhood of a character for me to make him real in the present moment. But I do. For me, I really had to justify why was he there, number one, and the connection with Lorelai.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, the connection with Lorelai, I very early on when I read it, identified her as a little sister.
Oh, interesting.
So my connection to her was dealing with a little sister that you really love, that is annoying, that doesn't know better,
mm-hmm.
and that you're there to guide her.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of framed that relationship. So with that knowledge, there's always going to be... We're always going to be connected because it's family, right? So no matter if we fight, no matter how rude I am, you can be rude with family.
Right.
There's a place where you can be yourself is with family.
Mm-hmm.
So it justified kind of everything in their dynamic for me.
Sure. Well, and that's interesting that you see it as a little sister.
Yes.
Because so much of the show seems to be a lot of the stories are Michelle yearning to be included.
Right.
In those dynamics or with like Suki and Lorelai and what they're doing and
right.
making sure he's part of the in crew and everything.
Right. But for me, just the nature of the relationship, mm-hmm. I had to, you know, was it going to be, I could have chosen like a love interest, but then you don't, then the stakes are different if it's a love interest, if it's right. someone. So the nature of the relationship had to justify their dynamic. Mm-hmm. And that, by putting her my little sister, it kind of justified everything for me. Kind of made sense.
Right.
As far as like him living in that little village, I have met, well, first of all, there's an episode where is exactly what I felt like Michelle was. There's an episode where there's a group of French people mm-hmm. coming. And he pretends that he's from Texas. By the way, you guys are from Texas.
That's true.
And howdy do.
Yeah. And they're like, oh my God, they recognize the accent. And they're like, oh my God, you know, they say in French, oh, you're French. And Michelle says, no, I'm just a little boy. I'm just a simple boy from Texas.
Yeah.
You know, but with the French accent right. because he doesn't like French people.
Oh, he's a self-loathing French.
Yeah, but I know those people. Like, I know those people here in LA. Yeah. I know those people in New York where they left France. France is like the government, the taxes are insane. Mm-hmm. You can pay up to 60%
Oof.
Of your salary.
Oh, so really?
A lot of, yeah. And a lot of, and it's really, really hard to get new jobs. Like, it's a country that lives a little bit in the past.
Sure.
And it's tough for the French people, younger generation. So a lot of them leave.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them want to get as far as possible from other French people.
Sure.
And so I saw him that way. So anywhere but France. Anywhere but France.
Sure.
And so he ended up in that little village. And I think he found a family with her and within that town.
Right.
So that kind of justified it for me for him to stay there.
And within the end, and that workplace often becomes family over right. time. It's a very
right.
familiar dynamic.
Exactly.
I love stories where we get more shades of who he is, because it feels like Michelle was never given like a whole A story right. in an episode, but when his mother comes to town or
right.
things like when he's working at the Calvin Klein place for a little bit and they have right. to recruit him. And
yeah,
I wanted to know more what was going on. Did you share yeah. that as well? Just like,
yeah, for sure. But you know, he was never a big part. So that's why I was always very surprised the attention that my character got, because I always felt like I was there a minute. So I was always like, huh. But I think his ability to express out loud what a lot of people don't allow themselves to say, like, you know,
sure.
really.
Kind of like Paris.
Yeah, kinda, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I think that was very joyful for people.
Sure.
Really, yeah. But yeah, I would have, listen, there's not an actor on the planet that doesn't want to have more
stories. Yeah. Yeah.
Give me less lines, less story
less
lines. It's too much. Yeah, but you know, it was a show about the girls and I was just there to be part of that family and mm-hmm. that environment. But yeah.
And for you, when you look back on the show, because there's so many different parts of it, and there's so many parts of it that aren't as glamorous and are tough, and things like the long hours and different things and shooting schedules and blah, blah, blah. But what represents the best part about working on that show for 7 years and for that time of your life?
Yeah.
Coming to LA, it's your first audition. It's a job that lasts for 7 years. It gives you recognition, validation machine.
Yeah.
What do you think was the best part of it?
The I have to say the validation, because I've worked on many shows, and you don't always get the response that you wish you would get.
Sure.
And when you're on a show that you find well written, that you find clever and interesting and funny and all of that stuff, and that the public agrees with you,
mm-hmm.
and they get as excited, if not more, and surpass what you had in your head, that's kind of magical, and that kind of rarely happens. And I think for me to be on a show that was so well received And I'd been on many Canadian shows, but I'd never been on a show. Canadian shows don't travel that much. So you travel in the world, you go to Europe, no one knows who you are. So for me to be like in Puerto Rico and or, you know, in Italy in a village where they barely speak English and people are freaking out, I'm like, oh, my God, I don't even understand what you're saying. Like, how do, there's some – but that's – American culture and the power of Hollywood and being on a show here. You're on a show here, you're on a show on the planet, because if the show's successful, it's sold everywhere. I was not familiar with that. And so that was very shocking to discover and very exciting. Very exciting to go to countries where you don't understand the language, but they know who you are. That's been very a particular experience I'd never had before.
Yeah, the international appeal of shows is like... I feel like people always underestimate it.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, yeah, people are over there. They enjoy this thing.
It's kind of crazy.
It's really cool.
Yeah.
So what's the kind of stuff you like working on now? You own a business now.
I own a business for 2 years now. I own a spinning studio in Montreal, which is a huge hit, which I just kind of opened one day. I was here.
Yeah. What was the passion?
Well, because I'm a sport maniac. I love exercising. Mm-hmm. And I screwed up my knees jogging too much. And I couldn't jog anymore, and I was looking for something, a cardio exercise that would give me the same intensity, and I ended up trying SoulCycle, loved it, ended up going 5-6 times a week. And then I was here 3 years ago, and I was going back to Montreal in April, and I was like, oh, we don't have that in Montreal. What am I going to do all summer, not being able to do my cardio? I was like, this is silly that Montreal doesn't have that. I should open it. And that thought was like at the end of March. And by September 22nd, I was open and people were spinning.
Wow.
I just decided to do it. That summer, I was not shooting anything. So I just opened it and it became a huge hit. And so that's that. But I've been every year pretty much doing a show in Canada ever since the show ended. Now I just finished the second season of a series that I was doing last year called La Théorie du Chaos, The Knockout Theory, if you translate it in English, which is about the wrestling world. It's comedy. And I play some right wing.
A wrestler?
No. Oh, my God, no. No, I play some right wing gay accountant that is very old school values. That's a lot of fun.
A gay accountant with old school values.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. He's married. They have two kids. And then the last episode I shot was my husband who wanted to go back and work. Mm-hmm. And I was very, very angry the whole episode. And that was that felt like I'm the one working and bringing the money. You should stay home and take care of the kids. Like really, like in the old days, the wife stayed.
Funny.
Yeah. Stayed home wife. And yeah.
There's no wrong way to start a family.
Yeah, but great writing. Great. It's a great show.
Cool. Like
it. Yeah.
Right on.
Yeah.
Well, I guess when we always ask like people who come on the show, like what sort of interesting stories or things that we may not know about like the behind the scenes process of the show. We've had Liza Weil and Sean Gunn share some interesting things, but are there any particular days that stand out particular of shooting Gilmore or the show where it's like, wow, that was weird or that was crazy or that was a lot of fun?
Well, I had all of that crazy, a lot of fun. That was weird. There was an episode, I mean, just as far as I'm concerned, there was an episode in season one, I think it was like the third episode. No, it was an episode where I was afraid of the swans. There were some swans
something. Yeah, that was like in the first season.
First season. And I, for some reason, I could not get, there was a very simple line. And I started like not being able to say the line. So 2, 3, 4 times, 5 times. So I was like, okay. But then it got to a point where after 10 times, like I was like, okay, I don't know what's happening. I don't know how to say that line. And it's a stupid line. And so we tried it a couple of times again. Wouldn't work. I would still have an issue with the line. So Amy came and just, do you need a break? And you know, this is crazy. Like that line is and I would be able to say the line outside of like without the camera
without
on me.
The camera.
But as soon as the camera would be, I just had like a mental block. I had never sweat so much in my life. I was so, like, I didn't understand what was happening.
Do you remember the line?
I don't remember the line. Thank God.
You've been set free.
Yeah, I've been set free. I don't remember the line. I'm sure I remembered the line for like a month after that.
Sure.
But no, I mean, the long hours and the long days were particular because there's something that happens when people are really tired. You start laughing for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. And I kind of laugh. Yeah, the loopiness. And I've had that with Lauren and Melissa a lot. And that's always been fun to me. But I remember a long episode where I was with Sally Strutters and Liz Torres.
And oh, we love a good Sally and Liz story.
I know. And they didn't have a chair for some reason, whatever. So they were standing. It was warm. We're outside and it took forever and this and that. And then after a while, Liz turned around and said to me, "Don't they know who we were?"
Who we were.
Yeah, I remember that line.
From all the stories, like Rose was talking, like how during those town meetings or whatever, like that Sally and Liz would kind of be like the warm-up comics,
yeah,
keeping everyone going like, "All right, guys, what are we going to do now?"
Yeah, just yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Know, I can see that. Up there. I was never in those scenes. I think once I was in the town scene. Yeah. But you know, I the long hours and those crazy days were memorable because of the laughters
the fun came
with
it.
And one scene with Ed was very, very smart. And there's something what I was trying to describe before,
mm-hmm,
being like an older character. Ed has that, like, there's something aristocrat about him, like, mm-hmm, he looks like he's from royalty. There's something about him
from another time,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that was a little bit how Michelle was described. So that's why I think on the breakdown, so mm-hmm, I think that's why they were looking for someone older, because usually someone younger doesn't have that,
right?
But Ed had that. And we had a dinner scene. I don't even remember what the scene was, but Ed, for some...
I remember what it was.
Do you?
Yes.
Okay.
It's where... It's the Bracebridge dinner episode.
Is that what it is?
At the end. Yeah. Because
at the end, yes.
Yeah. And everyone's telling stories and...
Right.
Yes. But so, continue.
But Ed was like next to me. And we had to pretend that we were making conversation,
yeah,
right? But that without really, don't without really, yeah, yeah, pretending you're talking. And he would say the most nasty thing. but while keeping, you know, his demeanor,
right,
like very chic and, you know, and he would make me cry. The things that would come out of his mouth was so dirty. And I love that stuff. So he really made me laugh that day. I remember. I it's so crazy that he's not here anymore, but such is life. Yeah.
That's what if we get so, that's so fun to hear those stories,
yeah,
like that he was kind of a rapscallion.
Yeah.
Cuz he has so much inherent dignity.
Dignity,
to,
exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that contrast
that contrast is very funny.
It's great.
Yeah.
He's the world's grandfather.
Exactly.
He's the world's grandfather.
Yeah.
As well be.
It's funny. We remember that scene particularly because we have a clip that we often play. Do you have it?
I do.
Oh, really?
Here's what we do on the show is we play the theme song,
yeah,
and then we got to that episode, and that's where that's one of the only scenes I think you, Michelle and Richard have together.
Yes.
And they're talking about Cher.
They're talking about Cher. Do you believe in life after love?
Oh, is that what we're talking about? That's very vague.
And then Michelle says,
"I like that song."
So we play that clip at the end of our
episode. Oh,
at the
really?
End of every episode of this show.
Oh, that's funny.
We sing the theme song. And then we play the little soundbite of Michelle saying,
"I like that song."
That's funny.
It would be an honor
what?
For us to get a clean version of that clip.
Sure, I can
should
do
we
it.
Sing? Is that how we should end the show?
By singing it and then having you say it?
Okay, sure.
Would All that right. be great? All yeah. right, let's do it. Well, Yannick, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
For joining us on the show. This
fun.
Has been such a blast to get into these memories and see what brought you here. And also, congrats on the good English now.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that was a long process. It's not perfect yet, but it's
but I mean,
much
imagine
better.
The
it's
difference great. Between like the first season oh, yeah, crazy. Of the show yeah. versus when it ended. It must yeah. have been that. So you were working with like a dialect coach throughout.
Yeah, well, not during Gilmore because it was very easy for me because Michelle had an accent.
Okay. Right?
So it didn't have to be it was actually good for me to have some words that were foreign to me.
Okay.
No, I used it.
Oh, yeah. Right on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And do you have anything to plug? Where can people find you on social media? People can
oh, my God.
You?
I feel like I'm 95 years old. I am so... I think I'm not narcissistic enough. I don't find my life interesting. I don't like taking pictures of myself. I had a friend who just created an account for me on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
I think I tweeted three things. I must have like five followers.
I think we retweeted one of them.
Oh,
yeah.
Really? I really like. I tried for like a minute. I think if I'm on a show, like I'm doing a new show. I'm a guest. I'm a recurring guest star on a new show called Sing It. On YouTube Red. YouTube is going to be like
that's
Netflix.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right. And so they have three original series, and I'll be part of one of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a show that talks about the singing contest shows like American Idol.
Right.
And maybe when the show will start or I'll make an effort of like tweeting and stuff. But I think both accounts, Instagram and Twitter, is under my name.
Yannick Trussell.
Yannick Trussell. Instagram I'm using a little more. I find it more friendlier thing to put. Like last night I took a picture of my costume and I posted it. Like I feel it's less intrusive and I don't have to talk about anything. I don't really find my life interesting, so I don't know what I would tweet about, honestly, unless I'm on the show or something.
We'll give you a Twitter tutorial after this show.
Okay. I really need one. Yeah.
Well, you're talking to the right people.
Yeah.
Kinda. All right. Well, Yannick, thank you so much for joining us and we'll sing the theme song.
And I have to say, I love that song, right?
I like that song.
I like that song. Okay, yeah, just wanted to make sure I had the right line.
Do you want
line.
Me to play it for you again, just so you know?
Go for it.
Here we go.
Hold on.
My ways, young lady.
Oh, no, that's Richard.
I like that song.
Okay, perfect.
There we go.
Okay.
All right, here Let's we go. Go. This is so fun. We're doing it live.
If you're out on the road, feeling lonely and so cold.
Do you know this song?
Yeah. All you have to do is call my name and I'll be there.
It's harmony.
You'll know the next train choo-choo where you leave.
Oh, yeah.
I will follow anywhere that you tell me to.
If the anticipation is so big.
You need me to be with you. I will follow.
Yannick
Trussell, I will follow on the Instagram and the Twitter. If you need me to be with you, I will follow where you lead.
I like that song.
Yeah!
Yes! Flawless. Oh, it's starting again. Okay. Goodbye, everybody.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.